And now, a segment from the Best of the Night Side with Barb DiGiulio podcast. Listen and download the latest podcast at newstalk1010.com.
One of the stories that broke just a little while ago, and it's an important one, and it's an education one, and affects a lot of people. Starting in September of 2017, schools will have to provide before and after school care for students up to the age of 12. This is according to Associate Minister of Education Indira Naidu Harris. She focuses on early years education and child care, and her goal is to increase access to child care programs. Anyone who has school-age kids knows this is an issue. A lot of parents work 9 to 5, both parents do, and they work hours that make it difficult to, you know, what do you do if you have to leave for work at 7 in the morning and your child doesn't start school till 9? And if you are getting off work at 5:36, but your child gets off school at 3 or 3:30, well, parents have had to find before and after school programs, sometimes with YMCA, community programs, daycares. Now it looks like the school boards will be responsible for this all across Ontario. Joining us to talk about this is the president of the Society for Quality Education, Maddie DiMuccio. Hi, Maddie. Thanks a lot for doing this.
Hi, Barb. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Yeah. Is this a surprise to you?
Well, the deadline is a bit of a surprise. I mean, we learned, I think it was last week, where, you know, they were going to provide, the government was going to provide licensed childcare spaces. But, and you mentioned it a bit, I mean, who's going to be delivering this? And these are some of the questions we actually don't know. We're not very clear. You know, it's not clear, for example, if the government is going to allow third-party providers after September 2017 or whether these new positions will receive union wages and benefits. I think that's a really important question. We don't know if there's going to be additional cost to parents who wish to enroll their kids in the before and after school board program. And, you know, if the government intends that school boards offer the service for free, you know, and that these are high-costing union jobs, then I have to question if the school boards can handle this. And, you know, we already see school boards cutting core resources and other programs, and some boards are considering closing and selling off low-enrollment schools. So I'd hate to see that before and after school program result in more cuts to education.
Well, I mean, when it comes to before and after school programs, I'm only coming at it from a daycare perspective. There are different bylaws and different requirements when it comes to kids of a certain age. And then I also wonder, with school boards saying that they are billions in backlog for repairs that need to be done, how does this suddenly just happen? That, I mean, there are things to be considered, like, where are these programs going to be? You can't always just turn one classroom into an after-school program.
Well, you're absolutely right. And the minister needs to come clear about what she expects with her promise of licensed child care spaces in school. And, you know, the press release I read didn't make any mention of these details. You know, and I know that child care is necessary to allow parents to enter the workforce. We know that child care is expensive as well for many families. But, you know, if the government is saddling the cost of licensed child care spaces into the school boards, then the education dollar, which, as you said, is already stretched to the limit, may not be able to fulfill its primary mandate of educating our kids. And do you remember, I don't know if you remember this, Barb, but when we went to everyday full-day kindergarten, most boards wanted to hire ECE-certified workers to accommodate this because there was a demand for that. And the provincial government at the time, they said no, and the Liberals mandated that only fully qualified teachers could be hired, and that placed a significantly higher cost on the service provided for full-day kindergarten. So I'm anxious to see how this is going to be paid for and what that involves as well. And it could happen again in Ontario.
When are we expecting to get these answers?
Well, a good question. I mean, I searched, as I'm sure you did as well, I searched to try, you know, I looked at the press release. I got it a couple weeks ago. I looked at the news today, and I didn't see anyone asking those questions, first of all, but I didn't see any answers to those questions. And I'm surprised that I mean, that's a huge, huge deal to know how this is going to be delivered, yep, to know how who's going to pay for this and how it's going to affect our education dollars, which are being stretched as it is.
Before I let you go, do you think it's the responsibility of school boards to provide before and after school programming?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, I think I think that each individual school should be able to have that choice. I know some of them do, some of them do, and some of them don't. But it is a service. But, you know, I'm a big believer in the free market. If people need the service, then the service will come. And whether it's the government's role or the private sector's role, I think there can be a balance, but I think it needs to be responsible.
Maddie, as always, thank you so much for this.
Thank you so much, Barb.
Maddie DiMuccio, president of the Society for Quality Education. School boards must provide before and after school care starting next September. So let's ask you the question I just asked Maddie. Is it the school board's responsibility to provide before and after school programming for our school-age kids? This will be from ages 4 to 12. Who is going to pay for this? Will the parents pay for this? Should the parents pay for this? Is this yet another bit of pressure on the taxpayers? Because as Maddie mentioned, well, maybe they need to hire new people. And will those people be union people? And will they have benefits? And will they have pension plans?
I think that each individual school should be able to have that choice. I know some of them do. Some of them do, and some of them don't. But it is a service. But, you know, I'm a big believer in the free market. If people need the service, then the service will come. And whether it's the government's role or the private sector's role, I think there can be a balance. But I think it needs to be responsible.
The Nightside continues with Barb DiGiulio on News Talk 1010.
Welcome back to the show. That was Maddie DiMuccio, president of the Society for Quality Education, responding to the news that school boards will have to provide before and after school care starting September of 2017. In an email to CBC News, Associate Minister of Education Indira Naidu Harris said starting next September, schools will have to provide before and after school care for students aged 4 to 12. She says that's why we're making it mandatory starting September 1st, 2017, for school boards to provide before and after school programs. She said her goal was to increase access to child care programs. Says this will also include access to more recreational and skill-building programs to get kids more active and engaged. We're making these changes to expand both access and options for before and after care for children across the province and to make everyday life easier for families. Is this something that the school board should be responsible for? My kids were in a before and after school program, and it was a third party. It wasn't the school board. It was a non-for-profit daycare that operated out of the school, which is very hard to find because that's always the best if you can find one right inside the school. But we paid for it. Nobody is telling us who is going to pay for this, whether or not parents will have to pay, whether the school board is going to have to hire new teachers, new early childhood educators with, or will they be union? Will there be benefits and pension and all of that? Do we end up subsidizing it even if parents have to pay for the service? 416-872-1010. Text us at 71010. Marnie is in Toronto. Hi, Marnie.
Hi, Barb. I enjoy your show. I don't always call in but want to, but I had to call in tonight.
Thank you.
I'm a full-day kindergarten teacher. I've been teaching for 3 years. We currently, our school boards, do not have the money even to fund these classrooms properly. As a kindergarten teacher, I spend lots of money in updating toys that get broken. Thankfully, I have 3 young children that no longer use their Thomas the Train sets and all of these different toys that I bring to the classroom. But if not, there is no money for this. I spend hundreds of dollars personally. So.
Yeah, you could also speak to this, I'm sure. And I know a bit about this because I sat on a daycare board for 7 or 8 years. When it comes to before and after school programs, you don't just take kids age 4 to 12 and put them in a room together. You have different rooms for different age groups. You have different ratios for teachers to students. It's not exactly the same as just having kids in a classroom.
Barb, I agree. In fact, I am working with the before and after school care who just opened up for the kindergarten program in my classroom, and their standards are so different.
Yeah.
They were very nervous about sharing with a teacher. They didn't know how I would react. I have given them space. Their standards are different. They are privately funded, but like they are not for profit, and they bring in things. I had students that don't go to the daycare, that don't do the daycare program, that were so mesmerized with their classroom because it had changed a few extra toys that were brought in from the daycare programming that they pay for and replenish. If not, I would be doing all this myself with personal funds.
So you think there's just no way that the government can afford to do this?
No, and I'd be actually very nervous for it. The whole full-day kindergarten, I don't think we envision 30 children in these small classrooms with one bathroom. Some have no bathrooms. I would be nervous to put my children in a before and after care that was run by the board if those numbers existed, because that 15-to-1 ratio does not exist in this age group in the daycare, which is why it's a different service completely.
Marnie, I appreciate your call. Thank you so much for that. 416-872-1010. Should it be the school board's responsibility to provide before and after school care starting September 26th? 17. Apparently, we have been told via an email from the Associate Minister of Education to CBC, she is Indira Naidu Harris, that it is going to be mandatory starting next September. Ian's calling from Mississauga. Hi, Ian.
Hey, Barb. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was thinking about this on the drive home, and I think the school board should be looking at this and maybe overseeing the program. The challenge is, obviously, with the cost. I don't think they should be providing unionized, higher paid staff when you have people like ECE, trained people that are out there that can do something like this. The biggest thing they have is they have the asset of the building, which is already up and operational, with the parking spots, the hydro, the heat, electricity's all there. For parents, it's safe. You know they're in there. And the infrastructure is fine. And then it almost challenge each school or perhaps even the board if they're in a district that money that they use using this program can go back towards their school for the improvements that it may need. And I think it's something that you charge the parents for and not the general tax base, because the general tax base is meant to educate our children. This, of course, has an educational component to it, but really is it's replacing, perhaps for some, the before and after program that they already pay for through something like you said, the YMCA.
Or daycare, an independent daycare, yeah.
Or even having a nanny at home like we do, because we have three young ones, so it actually works out even a little better for us. But, you know, you can let them compete with those private people, but they'll have the advantage they should have the advantage of a lower overhead because they already have the building up and running.
All right, Ian, thanks a lot for the call. I can speak to that from experience. If you have a third-party daycare, try to get permission to operate in a school. It is almost impossible. The school boards do not want, oftentimes, any part of an independent daycare. They want, it's either their program or they're not going to just open the doors and say, hey, we've already got the classrooms. Come on in. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Wow. My brain is on fire. It's just like, what on earth? People make couples, husband, wife, partner, whatever you want to call them, make conscious decisions to have children. I'm a single guy, no kids. I already supplement those children through my taxes. And then I do it at work. I work with people that arrive an hour late for work because they got to drop their kid off, and they need to leave an hour early because they need to pick their kid up.
Yeah, but so, I don't think this is I don't think parents are demanding this. I think this is just the government saying that this is going to happen.
I'm from the government, and I'm here to help you. This is ridiculous. If you choose to have a child, or for lack of a better term, a dog, there are costs associated with that conscious decision when you choose to make an infant or a human being, and guess what? You knew that going in, and don't turn around and say, or the government turn around and say, oh, we're going to supplement that because your kid could be the next prime minister. It's ridiculous. There is a cost associated with their food, their school, their education, their shoes, and their clothing, and you knew that going in. Don't come to the trough, ask for a handout because you chose to have a kid.
All right, Greg, we hear you loud and clear. I like the idea of the programs being, I'm telling you, it is so convenient if you have a before and after school program in the school that your kids go to. But I don't think that, I think, you know, parents have been paying for that service all along. And I think, especially when kids get to the school age level, it is much easier/cheaper to pay for before and after school programs than it is to pay for daycare. And I just don't see, in the state that the government is in right now, and the school boards, and the money that still needs to be spent to repair the $3.5 billion in backlog of all the repairs, and how in the world are we going to be able to afford this on top of it? Those questions remain to be answered. I'm sure we'll all be paying very close attention to this one. Apparently, it is going to be a year away. This one was really surprising this afternoon. Toronto's public and Catholic school boards are scrambling to find a solution to an unanticipated bus driver shortage. TDSB officials say some 60 school bus routes across both boards are without a dedicated driver to start the academic year. 60 routes across two school boards. It's not clear how many students are affected, but parents have been told that kids who ride routes under contract to Attridge Transportation, Wheelchair Accessible Transit, or Sharp Bus Lines may expect significant delays and the possibility of buses not running at all. Ryan Bird, spokesperson for the TDSB, says in some cases they are having to call cabs for the students.
I mean, significant delays, and students are not being picked up on time, and they're being delivered late home.
And in some cases, staff members are getting involved. So you might have your child's principal drive him or her home. Maybe the math teacher says, I'm free this afternoon, I can take some of these rides. Well, the problem is that there are so few drivers for the routes that some drivers are dropping kids off, doing one route, and then coming back for another, and kids are having to wait at school. The service disruptions affect both morning and afternoon pickups. Ryan Bird says that arrangements are being made to ensure that the kids are supervised at school while they wait for a ride. Well, I hope so. At the very least, I would hope that they're looking after the kids. John Yan is a senior coordinator with the Toronto Catholic District School Board, and he talks about the effect of this on the students.
It means that routes in which drivers were assigned are empty, and drivers that are on call are doing double, if not triple, routes.
As a parent, would it bother you? I mean, it's ridiculous to even, as a parent, would it bother you to have your child's teachers or a random teacher at the school drive your child home? Do we not need to have a little bit more organization? And is there not one person, and I ask that knowing the answer is yes, is there not one person or a team of people who are responsible for organizing the bus routes? That's somebody's job. You had all summer to do it. How can we have a shortage on 60 bus routes between the TDSB and the TCDSB? 416-872-1010. Text us at 71010. And if you're a parent being affected by this, I would love to hear from you. Sam is calling from Thornhill. Sam, you run a small school bus company.
Yeah, yes, I do. And I found it very interesting, the whole discussion. I figured I'd call in. I'm hoping I can maybe illuminate some of the reasons why we're sort of facing this problem.
All right, let's hear it. We would love to hear that.
Sure. Well, I mean, number one, I think most people don't really understand what's involved in being a school bus driver. So there's a bit of a barrier. You need to do a special license, obviously, and that takes time and there is a cost. A number of companies, I mean, I'm a small owner operator myself, but a number of companies will pay for drivers because of this shortage. So if you wanted to learn to be a driver, they pay for your classes. In addition to having to get this license, there's also just the salary, which is quite low, simply because of the hours worked. I mean, you're talking 2 to 3 hours in the morning, maybe another 2 to 3 in the afternoon. So you're talking 4 to 6 hours a day. The salary these people make is, you know, could be anywhere from $1,000 to $1,500, and therefore it's not a very sort of in-demand kind of job.
Sure, sure.
You're not trying to hire people for that. Not many people are running to these types of jobs for that wage.
No, but it's that sort of part-time. And sometimes you see sometimes mom with young kids.
Yes.
I remember a mother with young kids would be driving the school bus because the kids could sit there with her. I mean, these are the kinds of jobs. It's sort of like a part-time to make some extra money.
Yeah, these are great for parents with small children, for people who are retired. So it's good as a supplementary income. I mean, it's not a very, it's not a very difficult job. It's not very labor intensive. I mean, you know, driving is fairly fun. A lot of people just enjoy Driving, it's pretty interesting. It's a cool experience to drive a school bus sitting so high on, on the road.
Sam, while I've got you, I want to ask you a couple of questions. One is, so what is your reaction to teachers, principals, administrators stepping in to drive kids home because there are not enough bus drivers?
Well, I mean, you know, my number one concern as an owner-operator is just the safety of the children. I mean, I go through a lot of rigor to make sure that not only my buses are safe, but my drivers are well-trained, that they know the routes, they know the emergency procedures. I have all the contact information for all the kids, the you know, emergency contacts. You know, and I'm guessing as long as the teachers and principals are sort of trained in that manner, I guess I wouldn't have a problem with it, but I would just be concerned that if you're taking someone who happens to have a license and has maybe never driven in 10 years and throwing him in a bus, you know, it's just unsafe. It could be unsafe for the children potentially.
Well, I mean, my understanding is that, no, these teachers and principals are taking the kids home in their own vehicles.
Well, that's, I mean, a little bit more dangerous. It comes question of insurance. I can tell you on the school bus, I have to have at least $10 million liability. There's, you know, special insurances. You have to have special licenses. You know, I would hate for someone to get even into a little fender bender and then have an insurance claim. Suddenly they have a couple kids that are injured. Perhaps they don't have car seats. Perhaps, you know, God forbid the insurance would leave them high and dry because they didn't do all the proper steps.
Can you understand my disbelief that we are finding out this information now when whoever is in charge of organizing the buses had all summer to do it?
Well, it's very shocking, I guess, to most people. But as an industry insider, I could kind of see this coming in the sense that it's very difficult to find drivers. Now, that's something they should have alerted the public to. They should have, you know, sent a call out way before. I mean, it's pretty unacceptable that, you know, just leaving parents high and dry with no way for their kids to get to and from school. But it's just an industry-wide problem, and I wouldn't be surprised if the problem actually continues to grow just because of the dynamics that are at play.
Sam, I really appreciate your call and thank you for the information. Apparently, contractors gave both the TDSB and Catholic School Board a heads up weeks ago that they were having a hard time finding drivers for the fall, but assured the boards they could probably have enough. They don't. 60 bus routes between both school boards have a bus driver shortage. Parents, some of the teachers are getting involved, the principals, vice principal, secretary. You've got coaches driving your kids home. Are you okay with that? Driving them home in their own vehicles. And also, in some cases, cab drivers are being called to get these kids home.
I would just be concerned that if you're taking someone who happens to have a license and has maybe never driven in 10 years and throwing him in a bus, you know, it's just unsafe. It could be unsafe for the children, potentially.
The Nightside continues with Barb DiGiulio on News Talk 1010.
Welcome back to the show. That was Sam, who called into our program. He is the owner and operator of a small school bus company. And he was talking about the story today that 60 bus routes at the TDSB and TCDSB combined are experiencing bus driver shortage. Contractors gave both boards a heads up weeks ago that they were having a hard time finding drivers for the fall, but assured the boards that they would probably have enough, and they don't. So drivers are taking kids home, then doubling back to the school to pick up more kids to take them on their routes. Some are putting kids in cabs. Some board staff are getting involved. You've got principals and teachers driving kids home in their personal vehicles. As a parent, does this concern you? 416-872-1010. You can text us at 71010. And I'm going to add, as a taxpayer, does it concern you that they had all summer to figure this out? We had to do a bus thing with one of our sons for a couple of years in a row, and we were pretty much told by the school, you will not hear back from the board after June and before the last week or so of August. They just shut right down. But you know what? This sort of stuff has to be in place for the first week of school. 416-872-1010. Here is Stanley in Markham. Hi, Stanley.
Hi, Barb. Nice talking to you.
You too.
Well, you know, it is concerning, and I'll tell you why. Because for decades, we never had any issues with the school system at all, Catholic or public school. But it seems in the last decade, the incompetence of the higher up running the school system. It's like we're a third world nation. This is Canada, 2016. I mean, you can buy houses. People are dropping money on houses of $1 million, no problem. And we can't even get a bus route. Look at the amount of taxes we pay as Canadians. What's wrong with the people running the school system? The kids are failing math. They can't add 2 + 2. They can't write a simple sentence. And now the bus route. Like, what's the incompetence level? The amount of money we're paying these teachers and the boards and the principals. And this all started with Kathleen Wynne that decade ago when she was the Minister of Education. Now she's at another level, and she left all the problems behind. She created everything.
How would you feel about your child being driven home by a teacher in their personal vehicle?
Well, like the last caller said, I mean, you're looking at a liability issue now, right? But this now the teachers are chauffeuring kids. Now, well, you got a principal. He has an Uber license. He's become an Uber now. It's ridiculous what the school system's become here in Canada. Third world countries are laughing at us.
Stanley, thanks a lot for the call. And my concern as a parent would also be, okay, thank you very much, Mr. Johnson, for driving him home today. Is this going to be every single day? Who's driving my kid home tomorrow? Is this going to be like a roll of the dice? Hey, who's available? And we need some teachers to drive kids home. Are you kidding me? Like, this is ridiculous. Someone texted in and said that the boards do have route coordinators who set student lists and map out routes. Companies bid on each route. Boards pick winning bids. School bus drivers are paid and treated as disposable. Companies won't know until the end of August who is returning. Most drivers will be new. There is no effort to retain. Jack is calling from Caledon. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Barbara. Pleasure speaking with you.
And you too.
I just passed a couple of school buses that are backed into people's driveways ready for tomorrow morning.
Well, great. At least some kids are getting a ride to school.
Well, what happens in a rural environment quite frequently is the school bus drivers, because we have the facilities here and the long driveways and the country properties, they take the bus home. It makes sense when you're only working two and a half, maybe 3 hours in the morning. Now, in an urban environment like Toronto, you don't have that benefit, that advantage. So hypothetically, a school bus driver, and you're saying you see them with the driver's small children there, they bundle up their small children, they go down, they get on the TTC, they take the TTC bus out to the yard where they get on their cold school bus, turn around and drive it back into the city, do their route for 2.5 hours, take the bus back to that yard, fuel it and take the TTC back home for maybe $30. After taxes, $25. They're going to do the same thing in the afternoon. It's a minimum wage job. That's how they're budgeted.
Okay, so, and there are a lot of people out of work that could use minimum wage jobs. It's not just single parents or parents with young kids.
But they're going to want, everybody's looking, you know, everybody wants either that 8-hour job, and then they're going to do it in the winter, they're going to do it in the rain, and when their children are sick. So they're recruiting to the, I hate to say this for school bus drivers, they're recruiting, in my opinion, to the lowest common denominator.
Jack, I'm going to let you go because I want to hear from a couple of other callers that we have on the line. Daniel is next. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, Barbara, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Go ahead.
So I have a child in the public school system, and I've found in TDSB, no interruption in his bus service. His school doesn't start until next week, actually.
Okay.
It's a specialized school for children with autism and other behavioral issues. But we got word he was a new bus driver, we got the name, and so the bus route hasn't stopped. That being said, you know, if the government organizations like the TDSB and the York Region School Board were run more like businesses, then this wouldn't be an oversight. So, you know, the fact that they're unionized, they don't have to work in the summer, it's not part of their contract. So some of these things can be left behind until the last minute, and I think that's exactly what happened in this case. And with regard to in their own vehicle, I wouldn't have a problem with that. I have another child who also has autism, who's with a private therapist, not in a public school, but she picks him up every day from our house and brings him back to our house. We've never had an issue. So.
As long as you know that's the plan every single day.
Exactly.
Yeah. Daniel, I appreciate your call. Thanks a lot for the call. And you know what? Let's not pin this one on teachers. There are administrators who work in the school board that are supposed to work through the summer, but we have been told as parents over the course of a number of years, don't expect to hear back from anybody in the summer. Nobody really works in the summer. Sean is in Hamilton. Hi, Sean.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Go ahead.
Yes, the school board was aware of this problem during the summer. But like you said, they didn't want to disrupt their summer vacation to tackle the problem and deal with it, because it's going to disrupt their you know, being out on the lake at the cottage or going away to Europe for 2 weeks.
Yes. Okay, Shauna, you know what? I don't want to turn this into a total bash. And first of all, the teachers are not the ones who plan the school bus routes, but there are people whose job it is to map out the routes, to make sure you've signed up with a company that has enough drivers, and that planning should not happen at the end of August. This should be worked on months ahead of time. I mean, we've gone through this personally. We had to deal with getting busing for one of our kids for a few years toward the end of elementary school. And every year it was waiting until the last minute because nobody addresses any of this until the very end of August as they're sort of gearing up. People are starting to come back into the office. And somebody wrote in and asked me if I'm fear-mongering. Teachers are not predators. No, no, no. I'm not saying the teacher's going to do something to your kid. I'm saying if the teacher drives your kid home today, how do you know? You can't, as a parent, go to work not knowing how your child is going to get home from school. So if this teacher has signed up to drive three kids home every single day, and we know that indefinitely, and this is the plan moving forward, that's the plan moving forward. But this random, we might call a cab, it might be the principal, it's ridiculous that this is happening, especially right now at the first week of school. This stuff needs to be worked out earlier. Somebody texted in or somebody called in and said, if the school board was run like a business, this wouldn't happen. Yeah, you know what? A lot of people would lose their jobs if the school board was run like a business. This sort of stuff would not be put up with. Thanks to everyone who called in and texted in. Interesting stuff coming up. Chris Lewis is going to join us. Have you seen those police cruisers that are gray and they're kind of, they call them a stealth mode? It's hard to see the lettering on the side. Well, apparently all police cruisers are soon going to have that look. We'll find out what Chris Lewis thinks, and then we'll ask you what you think when we come back. You're listening to The Night Side on In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. Toronto police cruisers are getting a drastic makeover. You may have seen some of the, they call them stealth vehicles. They're dark gray with dark lettering. They're actually really cool looking, but they're not so easy to identify as police cruisers at first glance. Well, the police service has confirmed that the entire fleet is being renewed. The new squad cars will be dark gray. Some cars are already in service. As I say, you may have seen them. Well, there are roof lights. The marking on those cars are considered stealth-like. The Riding Toronto Police and the TPS logo and the service's motto, to serve and protect, are in a dark color that blends into the vehicle. And the other ones are being phased out. The current cars are bright white with a blue and red stripe across the side. Eventually, you will not be seeing any more of those. Joining us to talk about it now is Chris Lewis. He is CTV News Public Safety Analyst, former Commissioner of the Ontario Provincial Police. Hi, Chris. Thanks a lot for this.
Hi, Barb. My pleasure.
Hey, those cars are pretty cool looking.
Well, they look good. I'm really shocked if the reports are correct that they're going to replace them all that way. They're certainly valuable in police work, having all marked cars with roof lights on top and, you know, very highly visible, which has its benefits as well. That just doesn't totally work. You need to have a blend, and some of those are a good option in terms of high crime areas and some other enforcement activities.
So with these stealth-looking vehicles, is it absolutely no mistaking they are meant to blend into the surroundings?
Yeah, they don't. I mean, if you see them from the side, without a doubt, you're going to know it's a cop car. If you come up one behind one on the road, you may or may not right away. If you pass one, like, 'cause you're driving like an idiot, you might not know until it's too late, which is part of the purpose of them.
Yeah.
But you still need marked cars that are highly visible. That, you know, you imagine those cars escorting, you know, a funeral through the community, or are out in the garden or at a collision. You need the big lights. You need the visibility, and the visibility is good from a prevention perspective because a lot of people see cars, they know are cop cars, they automatically slow down or at least for the time being obey the law. And if they don't, then maybe one of the stealth cars will get them later.
I remember somebody, I think it was on a show, talking about how when you're driving along and you look in the rearview mirror and you see a police car behind you, you just, they said you have that mini heart attack. Where you,
well,
just,
you do, even
right?
When you're obeying the law. It's
exactly.
Like pulling up to customs and you're coming back from a trip, you feel guilty and you don't have anything with you.
But it's not a bad thing to have the visible vehicles. And as you're describing all the reasons why they're good, I'm also thinking about somebody being in trouble, a kid being lost, something like that, where they know the vehicle as soon as they see it.
Yeah, and that's the advantage of having a blend. I think probably the OPP, for example, the vast majority of their vehicles are fully marked. But they do have, and they have for a number of years, had cars like the stealth cars that we're talking about. At one point, they went all marked, unless it was an undercover car or a detective car, and then they slowly went back to a blend because sometimes the marked car just gets people to obey the law temporarily, and moments later, they're going to break it again. And so you want to try and catch those guys too, you know, not just from a prevention perspective, but stop them from killing somebody.
Would this move, you referred to it as surprising, and I want to ask you if it would surprise you based on the current, sometimes presumed climate between police and citizens, and maybe the message that it could give to some people that we're hiding in plain sight.
Yeah, and, you know, it's too bad that we would even have this conversation because it shows that, you know, in some respects, some relationships have deteriorated, although I think the City of Toronto still loves their police. Some may say, yeah, well, you're just trying to catch us. Well, you don't have anything to worry about if you're not doing anything wrong. You know, if you're not breaking into a store, you don't have to check the cars out that are coming to see if they've got roof racks on them. Obey the law. You don't have anything to worry about. But I can see some getting that kind of bent to their attitude, but, you know, too bad. I think Toronto Police need to do it right, have the right to mix of cars and use them properly, and it's all about public safety, not about, you know, getting tickets or that sort of thing.
So if the entire fleet is going to these stealth vehicles, do you think this is a good idea?
No, that's a mistake if that's what they're doing. I think there's some confusion somewhere in what they're saying. They're replacing their whole fleet. And here's an example, but is that the kind of car they're replacing their whole fleet with? I'd be very, very surprised.
Okay, so it may be being misinterpreted that they might be replacing the whole fleet of vehicles. Well, it's funny because the police confirming this news, I think at some point they were saying that all of the existing bright white cars will eventually be gone.
Yeah, and they may just all be a different color. It doesn't mean they're not going to be highly visible with lights on top and all that sort of thing.
All right.
I'd be shocked, Barb, if they went that route. It just flies in the face of everything that police do.
Okay, so and you, I think, would feel comfortable assuring people that it is about protection, not about catching people.
That's right. I mean, catching people is the necessity to smarten some people up. But it's not about the revenue grab, like some will say, oh, we just want to get more tickets. The bottom line is if you put a marked car out on the side of the highway and nobody speeds, nobody gets in a collision, nobody drives aggressively or attacks while driving, then that you've accomplished your goal, really. So if anything that makes people stop doing their bad behavior, that's a good thing. If they don't, then they're going to have to pay a fine, and maybe that teaches them a lesson.
Chris Lewis, thank you so much for this.
Anytime, Barb. Have a great night.
You too. I appreciate it. CTV News public safety analyst, former commissioner of the Ontario Provincial Police. So police service confirming that their entire fleet is being renewed. These new squad cars will be dark gray. You may have seen them. I've seen them out and about. Some cars are already in service. There are roof lights. The markings, though, are stealth-like. It's harder at first glance to identify these cars as police vehicles. And I kind of take the stance that Chris does, where he says, if you're not doing anything wrong, it shouldn't be an issue for you. But at the same time, he would be very surprised if they don't continue to have some very visible police vehicles in the fleet. Does it concern you that by changing the whole fleet to stealth-like vehicles, it might be more difficult to identify police cruisers in the city? Does it feel to you like possibly a form of entrapment? They just want to catch people more than protect?
It's too bad that we would even have this conversation because it shows that, you know, in some respects, some relationships have deteriorated, although I think the City of Toronto still loves their police. Some may say, yeah, well, you're just trying to catch us. Well, you don't have anything to worry about if you're not doing anything wrong. You know, if you're not breaking into a store, you don't have to check the cars out that are coming to see if they've got roof racks on them.
You're listening to The Night Side, hosted by Barb DiGiulio on News Talk 1010.
Welcome back to the show, and that was Chris Lewis, CTV News public safety analyst, former commissioner of the Ontario Provincial Police, Toronto police cruisers becoming more stealth-like. The entire fleet is getting a makeover. And you've seen maybe some of the new vehicles out there. The new squad cars are dark gray. Some cars are already in service. They have roof lights, but the markings are less noticeable than the ones on the traditional white police vehicles. The Riding Toronto Police and the TPS logo and the To Serve and Protect are in a dark color that blends into the vehicle. So the entire fleet is being replaced. The police service has confirmed that, but has not answered whether, in fact, all of the vehicles will be changed to these stealth-like ones. The current car is, as you know, bright white with a blue and red stripe across the side. If they do go to the all-stealth-look vehicles, are you concerned that it might be more difficult to identify police cruisers in the city? And does it feel like a form of entrapment, like they're more interested in catching people than in protecting people? 416-872-1010. Text us at 71010. Mark is calling from Bolton. Hey, Mark.
Hi. I think it's a total tax grab. And my biggest problem with it is police are supposed to be there to serve and protect. And if you can't see someone, how can they serve you? Police know that the only way to cut down crime in any neighborhood is visibility. And when they start hiding, They're going to increase crime. It's a total tax grab. You know, it's no different than when they put in photo radar and they started lowering the height of the stoplights. So when you're traveling two car lengths behind a transport trailer, you cannot see what color the light is until you've entered the intersection.
Yeah, true.
If the transport goes through, you're basically going to get nailed with that. All of policing is moving towards revenue generation, and it's a big mistake.
Do you really believe that, though? I mean,
I absolutely do. I think if the revenue coming from policing were not going to the municipalities or towards, in the case of the OPP, to the province, if it was handed to another agency to distribute for whatever purpose they deemed, whether it was roads, infrastructure, or public safety, you would start seeing a lot less of these maneuvers to try to entrap people. The only speeding ticket my wife has ever gotten was at the bottom of a hill in Mississauga. And the police are sitting there every single day because they know that that hill is going to increase your speed. Yeah. And they're going to be able to, they're just going to pick them off one after another.
Yeah, I get you. You know what? Thanks a lot for the call, Mark. I mean, I do get you. There are some spots, and we have some near our place, that we've got an area where people speed all the time, but it's in quite a wealthy area where, that's not the area I live in, but I'm close to it, where people will make a right turn that they're not supposed to. And there are two police cruisers sitting there waiting to ticket someone who's made a right turn, not harming anyone, but the people who are flying doing 70 in a 40 zone. Where are the cops when you need them? I mean, I get that part of it. But I still do believe that police officers are in it to protect. I don't think the police officers get into that line of work to be a part of a cash grab. Now, whether the higher ups are making decisions along those lines to make it easier for people to be caught, well, let's hear what you think at 416-872-1010. Text us at 71010. Toronto police cruisers, they're all going to be going to that stealth-like look. At least that is what it appears, as police confirm that the entire fleet is going to receive a makeover. Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Just the nerve of the police catching you when you're doing something.
Right?
Wrong.
I know.
It's hilarious. I think it's a stupid idea because, I mean, how many times do you flag down a cop when something's going wrong? And if you can't tell which car's a cruiser, I think this is just dumb. It's going to backfire.
It's hard to imagine not being able to identify the bright white police vehicles, because those ones are, anytime I see them, it takes almost a double look before I realize it's a police vehicle.
I still miss the yellow ones. At least those you could tell when it was a cop car, because no other car was painted that silly yellow. But I don't understand what the rationale or the mentality is behind this. Where do they benefit? Yeah, you're going to catch a few more people doing small things, but I think the benefits aren't going to be worth it.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Up until the early 1960s, Toronto police cruisers were all unmarked and were various colors. They were then painted that bright yellow that Steve was referring to, but those cars were replaced in 1986 with the white ones. So now we're seeing these dark gray, I keep saying it, but they are, they're kind of cool. They're cool looking vehicles. And they're a little bit harder, a lot harder to identify as police vehicles. If you're looking right at one, you'll see the sort of dark gray on gray writing. And they consider them more stealth-like. And there's a possibility that the entire fleet is going to be changed to that because the police have confirmed there will be a makeover of the entire fleet. Are you concerned that it might be more difficult to identify police cruisers in the city? Hi, Keith. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, how you doing? I think it's totally just a cash grab. They're just trying to blend in. Can you imagine if we painted our fire trucks some stealth color or our ambulances? You know, they're like that because occasionally they need to break the law. They travel quickly. They go through intersections. They need to be seen. You get pulled over at night by an unmarked car. You know, if I had a young daughter, I would be I would tell her, if you can't clearly make out that that's a police car, do not pull over. Who the heck knows who that is? Police cars are like that for a reason. And going to what you said about the guys always waiting on the, you know, no right turn on this intersection.
Yeah.
My brother was downtown. There was a no right turn. Unfortunately, the sign was, you know, 40 feet before the intersection. By the time he got to the intersection, you're looking through. It's not posted on the other side. He turns right. He gets pulled over. The cop says, you know, it's a safety thing. It's a safety thing. My brother said to him, it's actually not a safety thing because you're allowing me to break the law. If it's really about safety, why are you allowing me to put people in danger first? If it's a safety thing, go stand at the corner, and when you see someone with an indicator, say, I'm sorry, you can't turn right here. That's how you...
I got
you.
Yeah, I got you, Keith. And that, sorry to cut you off. And that is, yes, that is part of an issue here. And I think there are some instances where it serves the police well to be less visible. As Chris Lewis said, though, if you're not doing anything wrong, then you don't have anything to worry about. John is on the 403. Hi, John.
Hi, Barb. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
I just don't believe people are opposing this. They're coming up with every excuse to make this a nanny state. If you're not breaking the law, you don't get a problem. It's like speeding. It's like an illegal right turn.
What about the importance of vehicles being identifiable if somebody is having a problem or an issue and needs to locate a police vehicle?
Well, I kind of believe that they're still identifiable because nobody else is driving around with lights on the roof. Even if the car is gray, it shouldn't matter. The idea that the cops are out there trying to do it as a revenue grab, I don't buy it. You know what? They're trying to change behavior. One of the important things that they insist on is we have auto insurance. If you get caught driving without auto insurance, you get a fine of $5,000. Then they double it. They double it again. They keep doubling it. I think they ought to do that. If you get a speeding ticket, you get another one. You get another one. Just keep doubling the fine.
Yeah.
People will stop speeding.
All right, John. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Steve in Hamilton. Hey, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. How are you tonight?
I'm not too bad. I may have misunderstood, and I hope I did, but in one of your comments a bit earlier, you mentioned they were replacing all these vehicles with the gray ones.
That's...
And you said later they were making them over. So I'm really hoping they're wrapping these and not actually buying all new cars.
No, I think they're new cars. They're different vehicles.
Why don't they just save the tax dollars and just get some gunmetal gray wrap and wrap them like people do with their Porsches and Ferraris and...
Do people do that with Porsches and Ferraris?
Well, yeah, because it's cheaper to wrap a car than it is to repaint it, and it protects the original paint.
Yeah, I mean that's a question for the police force, but no,
it would cost a fraction to just wrap them.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot for the call. I got a text message from someone who's obviously a car person, so let me read it to you. I don't think from a public safety standpoint, as your guest explained, that it would be a good idea. However, I will say if you're worried they are doing this to be able to hand out more tickets, I would say it's a poor attempt. They are still relatively identifiable compared to a full undercover police vehicle. Just look for the push bar in the front, and the wheels are the biggest giveaway. Black steel wheels with like many people have for the winter tires, but the distinguishing feature is the chrome center cap on the black wheels. No one puts chrome center caps on black steel wheels anymore. Is that true, George? No one does that? George doesn't even know. George is a car person. It's a very old school thing to do, but all stealth cop cars still have them. I don't even know what you're talking about. I've seen the vehicles. I don't even know what you're talking about, but they are pretty identifiable. New research is warning parents that following outdated concussion advice could make their kids' symptoms worse post-head injury. A U.S. survey out of the University of California in Los Angeles tasked parents with talking about how they would care for their little ones if their concussion symptoms lasted for more than a week. Turns out 77% of nearly 570 parents said they would wake their kids up throughout the night to check on them, which is apparently a major no-no when experts now say that uninterrupted rest is crucial in helping the brain heal. Joining us to talk about some of the other things you may want to avoid doing if your child has a concussion is Dr. Nilank Jha, neurosurgeon, spine surgeon, chairman of Concussion. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Barb.
Great to talk to you. I haven't had you on for a while, and this is really interesting stuff. Having, especially one of my sons, go through football for many years, we know a number of kids who suffered concussions, and yeah, I would say waking kids up is one of the things that doctors would say. Just, you know, I guess it's that thing where make sure they're still conscious.
Yeah, it's a great point, Barb, and the study out of UCLA by Dr. Christopher Gies, I have the opportunity to work closely with him. And we have to be careful because when a child has a concussion or an athlete, we urge people to seek medical attention from a concussion expert. And the reason we do that is to rule out any type of sinister diagnoses. For example, if you remember Liam Neeson's wife, Natasha Richardson, who was skiing, she developed something called an epidural hematoma, which is much beyond a concussion. It's a bleed in the brain that can ultimately result in death. And historically, why we wake patients up in the middle of the night repetitively is to ensure that they don't have that particular condition.
Okay.
Because that can be surgically treated and death can be prevented. However, invariably, that condition is extremely rare. But the way to address this appropriately is any child or athlete with a concussion should immediately seek medical attention, ideally from a concussion expert, have a proper neurological diagnosis, rule out the presence of one of those sinister conditions, and then it's absolutely correct that they need to have proper cognitive and physical rest.
Okay, let's go over some of the other things that people, I think, are used to hearing if a child is recovering from a concussion. And of course, there are varying degrees. Another 84% of parents said they pulled their kids from all physical activity when apparently that kind of lifestyle after a concussion is not always the right thing to do.
Yeah, I have the privilege to see about 150 concussions a week, as you know, Barb. We've spoken before. And, you know, whether they're from professional athletes or kids. And what we notice is that after about 24 to 48 hours of some degree of rest, it's a good idea to start doing moderate levels of physical and cognitive activity. That does not mean return to contact sport, but going for a walk, you know, being with your friends. I can give you one example today of a young girl, about 15, who had a concussion. And initially, the parents didn't want her to look at her Instagram account, but that created more anxiety for her and worsened her condition. So I advise them that, you know, with limited use, let her stay connected to her friends. It's going to elevate her mood. Then she had her team at school going to a national championship out east for softball. And I advised to put her in a uniform, let her at least be with her teammates and go out there out east. She had a post-concussive syndrome, which is 10% of cases developed, but she went out east, wore the uniform, didn't play at all. They gave her the MVP award. Her mood was so elevated that everybody around noticed how much she progressed and recovered.
That's, you know what, it's great advice, and it makes me wonder if kids, anyone with concussions, if depression and anxiety is something that we need to watch out for.
We absolutely do. We know that if a child has a previous history of attention deficit disorder, a mood disorder, the risk for recovering is even higher. And if any child has anxiety before concussion, we often see that that anxiety is much exacerbated. So to give you an example, sometimes the children will want to go to school on day 3 or 4 just to attend school because they get a lot of anxiety about missing school.
Mm-hmm.
In that particular case, it's good to write a medical note and advise that there should be no tests, no assignments, no quizzes, but let them attend to keep their anxiety level low at least half a day or be around people. So there's a lot of things that we need to customize to the care. In other cases, the parents may be pushing the child back to school too quickly, even right. though they haven't recovered. The child goes into math class, and the parts of the brain used to process numbers, for example, they specifically have more headaches when they do math. Now, you may have an old school teacher who doesn't recognize the research in concussion and thinks that maybe this child is not genuine about their symptoms. And we need to be very careful to provide full support to the children as they phase back into academics and into schoolwork.
Is that an issue with some schools, with some adults who maybe grew up in a different time where concussions were really not really paid much attention to, where they may get the sense that kids are perhaps faking symptoms in order to get out of writing tests and things like that?
Yeah, very often it is getting much better, no doubt. The school boards are becoming more aware. They're becoming more progressive in their policies. I can tell you that, you know, in my experience, we don't see children who don't want to go to school, who want to fall behind, but there are still, in very limited cases, teachers and principals and others who sometimes we need to just give a call to and share with them what the recent research is. And very often with a conversation like that, they improve quite a bit. I can tell you one initiative that we're doing right now that I gave a talk at Ivy at the MBA program to the students there, and I gave a Series 9 talk, 9 slides, 9 minutes about concussions and the challenges that we're facing. And we developed a working group of major Canadian executives from across the country that are now building technology so that all the things that you and I have discussed right now, there will be software at the fingertips of children, parents, athletes, coaches, principles that they can access and have an algorithm in place, of course under the supervision of a medical doctor, but things that can really say what's the next step if the child is doing this, what do we do if now they're feeling better and they have no headaches.
Sure.
So we're really making some good movement.
All concussions are different, we know that, but in the milder cases, what kind of recovery time can parents expect so that they say, okay, this is actually a mild concussion and my child is starting to get better?
Yeah, generally 90% of concussions, we notice that within a week or two in children, they actually get better. And by day 4 or 5, if you notice that they're improving, they're feeling much better, the most important thing is to keep them out of harm's way and let them make a full recovery. Very often what happens is if they have a concussion on a Wednesday and they're starting to feel better by Friday, the parents think that it's important for this 12-year-old boy to go to his hockey tournament on Saturday morning because the NCAA scouts are going to be there.
I know.
And they don't realize or recognize that the brain is very vulnerable until a full recovery is made. In fact, 90% of second concussions in some studies happen within 10 days of the first for that very reason. So a couple principles I would really strongly urge your listeners: remove from play if there's any suspected concussion, sit out when in doubt, seek medical attention, ideally an expert in the field of concussion, for an early diagnosis and counseling with a proper neurological exam, 24 to 48 hours of rest. However, do not increase their anxiety. Allow them to check in with their social media accounts, keep in touch with those around them. After the 24 to 48 hours, moderate levels of cognitive and physical activity, gentle return to school and sport through a trained professional. If you follow those principles, you're going to have the best chance at a good outcome from a concussion.
Great stuff as always. Thanks so much for this.
My pleasure.
Dr. Neelang Jha, neurosurgeon, spine surgeon, chairman of Concussion, and they spell it with K's, K-O-N-K-U-S-S-I-O-N. They're doing some really fascinating work and really interesting stuff.
You've been listening to a segment from the Best of the Nightside with Barb DiGiulio podcast. Log on, listen, and download the latest podcast right now by visiting Newstalk1010.com.